Rats and Mice by Mike Duff. Location Victoria Station. So I'm walking down Miller Street, heading towards Victoria Station. I've had a drink and it's getting late. I notice a figure swaying in front of me. I recognise immediately the United shirt. It's one of them green and yellow ones, brought out to commemorate the centenary and Newton Heath's part in it. I fucking hate Newton Heath. Fucking smackheads and women with only eye shrunk the gyro kind of faces. And I get alongside him and our eyes meet. I look away but he's seen me. Fuck me with a wooden broomstick and call it the brush off. If it ain't me old mate Bobby Doyle, he says in a drunken slurred Welsh voice. Right, Bernie, I say, where you're off? A gleam comes into his eye and he offers me a can of Stella. Not seen you for a long time, signor. I'm off to the press club. You want to come? And I notice the Welsh voice has mellowed to near Mancunian after 30 years in this city. Quite a few of them spent in strange ways and other of Her Majesty's guest houses. We walk along together. It's maybe 2:30 in the morning. And my mind gets lost in useless thought and the tangents of time take over. And I think about the first time I saw Bernie. We were on a train heading for Victoria Station, just like now. Both aged about 14. We'd been a Blackpool. Davis was with a gang of Miles Platin lads, and I was with my cousin Rafferty. Rafferty knew them all, so no hassle. It was a good laugh at first, flinging light bulbs and toilet rolls out of windows and other kids' stuff. The train was one of them old sorts that had a corridor that ran right down the middle of the train, and you could swap compartments at will. No ticket collector on, so no authority figure to safeguard the interests of Mr. Commuter. Anyway, the train stops at Preston, and this suiting man gets on. Our compartment is full, so he settles down in one about 4 away. 10 minutes pass. By then we get bored. There's a little Livingstone in even the youngest Mancunian, so we go and explore. There's a girl with a good-sized pair of tits in one carriage, but her boyfriend's with her. And he's built like Jean-Claude Van Damme on steroids. So we leave them two well alone. We move a little further down and we come across Mr. Suit. And he's chosen to be alone too. Never mind, we'll relieve the boredom, says Davis, who's firmly in charge. And we all pile in. These seats taken, says Rafferty as he climbs on a luggage rack. The little shithouse. No chance of getting punched up there. Our host moves a few things for his uninvited guests, puts them in a briefcase, and then he commits suicide by speaking. No, you're all right, he says. And I wince. He's got a Scouse accent. A posh one, but Scouse nonetheless. There's a stunned silence at our end. We've caught an enemy spy. Hey, who do you support, our kid? Says Rafferty, as Bernie blocks the door. Now Mr. Suit is in a quandary, and I don't mean one of them places where you mine stone. He can't say United because of his accent. He can't say Liverpool or Everton. He must know enough to know that. And he'll get beat to fuck if he says he don't follow the beautiful game. I gotta say at this point, I was sort of enjoying myself. Didn't think it'd go much further, just a bit of fun. My mum had always kept me away from Rafferty and his crew. Said they were accidents waiting to happen. The Scouse lad is silent. He's roughly 20. But Bernie, though a kid, could do him any time he wanted. And that's without the others helping, which of course they would. Bernie decides to put the Scouser at ease. Don't matter to us, it's your business. And the Welsh accent gives the Scouser a little confidence, because he says, Liverpool. And I think a young Charles Bronson must be in the next carriage, because this is where he got the idea for the Death Wish films from. Rafferty's perched on the luggage rack and he begins to sing. In the Liverpool slums, in the Liverpool slums, they go to a dustbin for something to eat. They find a dead rat and they think it's a treat. In the Liverpool slums. The Scouser laughs a nervous laugh. Rafferty takes over the questioning. What's your name, our kid? Richard, says the sweating Scouser. Yeah, you look like a dick, says Rafferty, milking the laughter. Second of seeing you, I thought, this man is a dick. Bernie don't like the lot of attention. Like your briefcase, he says. Could do with one of them for me exams. Can I have it? Point of no return. Richard has to try and fight or cut and run, but he decides to do neither. Bernie empties the contents of the case over him and says, ain't really got no exams, but I can use this in a blagging. Then when the filth fingerprint it, they'll arrest you, because you're a scouser. And we all laugh. Richard is now staring out the window. I can see it's gone too far. The man is shaking with fear. If he was braver, he'd get the beating done with. He'd just butt Johnny Rigg by the door and see what happens. He makes a serious mistake. He slowly gets up to leave. We're nowhere near a station, so he's just being yellow. Bernie grabs him by the throat and throws him down. I never expected none of this. Rafferty shouts, see, has he got any money to lend us, Bernie? The scouser starts crying. He's bleeding while swimming amongst piranhas. I hate to see a man cry, says Bernie. So shut the fuck up! There's a horrible silence, filled only with the sound of Bernie going through Richard's pockets. The final act of humiliation comes when Bernie strips him of his watch and passes it to Rigger. The train pulls into Salford. Next stop, Victoria, Manchester. The game is reaching its climax, and Richard's only hope is Sean Claude getting off and going to Miver Big Tits. But reality is a bitch, because the train choo-choos out of Salford with the carriage lined up intact. I know what is happening is wrong, but I ain't got the bottle to stop it. Don't get me wrong, I ain't like Rafferty. I ain't frightened of none of them, including Bernie. It's just sometimes it's easier to be one of the boys. So I look on fascinated. Yeah. Now, says Bernie, we're going to play a little game. As he's saying it, he pulls a dice out of his pocket. The poor scouse kid is mesmerised. Let's have it right. He's willingly giving up his money, his watch, his briefcase and his self-respect. Know what the game is, says Bernie. The scouser shakes his head. And I'm praying the train pulls into Victoria and the game gets postponed and never replayed in Liverpool, with me casting the part of Richard. Though if that did happen, some fucker would get well and truly hurt besides me. Right, here's the rules, says Bernie. Explain them, Rafferty. Rafferty sits up on the luggage rack as best he can. His head is against the train roof. Right, he says. As you know, a dice is numbered 1 to 6. In our little game, you get to roll it. And if it comes up 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, we kick your scouse head in, Dick. Twat, I'm thinking. Rafferty ain't never kicked no fucker's head in, ever. Bernie takes over speaking. His face is a foot away from the scouser, and his eyes are mad. You're probably wondering what happens if it comes up 6, he says. The scouser is terrified. In his fear, he's both smiling and crying. If it comes up 6, then you get to roll a fucking gen, says Rafferty. Everyone is laughing. Everyone except Dick and me. I decide to end the game. No more humiliations. No rolling, no dice. I take the scouser out with one punch to the jaw. He falls sparkled. Everyone looks at me gobsmacked. We get off the train as fast as possible, and for all the wrong reasons, I'm immediately one of the gang. Bernie's full of admiration. What's your name, he says. Bobby Doyle, I say. And the clock ticks forward again, and we stand outside Victoria Station, all these years later. You coming to the press club, then, he says. Nah, I say. Got work in the morning. And we go our separate ways.
Portraits of Insane Women by David Gaffney. Art galleries are perfect for picking up women. A fact surprising to Warren, as his entire working life had been in art galleries, and he'd had no idea. He'd met his wife Georgina in a gallery, that's where they'd both worked. But the fact that people used Warren's carefully curated spaces to feed explosive, untiring sex lives appalled him. His efforts to waken the soul with the tender strokes of art were wasted. Years of registering, ticketing, cataloguing, placing, interpreting, caring, protecting meant nothing. The public didn't want his art. They wanted secret nooks for fleshy encounters, soft chairs, heavy curtains, peepholes, tissues even. His art gallery was a pickup joint and Warren a pimp. But Georgina had run away, with Vernon, a wedding photographer. And although he'd tried the bachelor life for a few weeks, without her, without Georgina, without a woman, his life was dingy and meaningless. Georgina's last email spurred him to do something. "Your vacuous chimp scrawl makes my eyes vomit," she pounded out in fat capitals. Where had she learned this language? It can't have come from Vernon, the quiet wedding photographer, who specialised in novelty poses for his couples. His Pulp Fiction setup was very popular. Warren had no bad feelings towards Vernon. He'd never met him, but he'd walked past the man's studio a few times, and once glimpsed him arranging a family portrait and using a puppet to make the children laugh. Warren wanted to stop doing furtive things, like watching Vernon using puppets to make children laugh. Warren wanted forward movement, and a new woman could give him this. And if Warren couldn't pick up a woman in a gallery, then who could? Manchester Art Gallery's revival of the Art Treasures of the UK exhibition from 1857 seemed an appropriate popularist choice. Many single available women would be wandering, unsupervised. All he needed was the nerve and the blood. Warren was appalled at the poor quality of the hang. The schools of Siena, Arezzo and Florence were chaotically jumbled together and ascribed in a slapdash fashion. He found no fulfilment in the art, but he spotted an interesting woman, slim, somewhere in her 30s, and with ginger hair, which made her seem more attainable. Her nose was small and turned up at the end. He decided to make his move in the photography section, where she was narrowing her eyes in intense concentration towards a landscape by Gustave Legne. Warren felt suddenly exposed and tiny. Words swelled like a bubble in his chest, and he thought he would never free them. Then he remembered the advice in the book. "Offer your feelings about the artwork, then reveal something personal." "Did you realise," Warren blurted, "that the sky and the sea parts of this image would have been exposed completely separately, then stitched together? It reminds me of my father." The woman pressed her lips together and widened her eyes, nodding slowly. "Did your father expose himself?" "Expose himself? No, no." She broke out in squeaking little laughter. "No, I didn't mean, I'm sorry, I mean, did he expose pictures? Was he a photographer?" "No, he was a grocer. I am Warren, by the way. Becky." Becky looked at Warren's face, then down to his shoes, which must have confirmed something, because she made a darting fish movement with her hand and a whoosh sound with her mouth, indicating they should overtake the couple in front and move on to the next picture. Rylander's Two Ways of Life. Warren and Becky were looking at art together. They were behaving like a couple. This was easy. Rylander's Two Ways of Life was made up of 36 separate negatives, stitched together in the way Vernon digitally merged different images to make the novelty film stills for his newlyweds. The photograph had been controversial in 1857, as it depicted orgiastic scenes involving bare-breasted women. Warren worried Becky would ask him which way of life he preferred, and as he would be inclined to say a little of both, he hoped to God she had read the same book about picking people up in galleries and knew to avoid direct questioning. "Sometimes I feel," said Becky, "that my life is lots of separate exposures stuck together, like I see the world through a giant fly's eye." "I know what you mean," Warren said. unable to imagine what she was talking about. The next display was a set of medical photos called Portraits of Insane Women, images that seemed to Warren exploitative and made him feel greasy. But Becky liked them more than anything else. Look at their faces. In those days, people knew how to be insane. You had proper mad people. Do you remember how street people used to mutter? You don't get that now. What happened to muttering? It was like a different language, burbling, rasping, full of passion and grit. I used to like to hear them muttering. When I was a kid, a woman used to follow me round the supermarket, softly singing and tittering. Another used to swear, "Where are they now?" She bent her neck for a new angle. You can see she is authentically deranged. The hollowness behind the eyes, the twisting of the mouth. Mad people have very thick hair, have you noticed? Do you think they have special shampoo in asylums? Warren was concerned about her attitude to the insane women, but he felt that these attitudes were something he could work on. He was out there now. You had to work with the materials you were given. That's what he'd read. In the cafe, Becky and Warren talked about their lives. She had recently broken up with her boyfriend and had been visiting the gallery for months. Warren was the first normal person she'd got chatting to. So when he proposed his plan, she was happy to agree. At Vernon's photography studio, Warren and Becky flicked through a few examples of poses. Vernon had many of the necessary costumes, but if need be, he could simply knock up the whole thing digitally. It was up to them. Warren, however, was prepared. He showed Becky the poster for 40s film noir Gun Crazy, and she agreed right away. The gaze in the woman's eyes was exactly like one of the portraits of insane women. Georgina would be amazed when she saw Warren with this red-haired girl in high heels, breasts bursting out of a tight green sweater, pointing a handgun at the viewer with Warren behind her, cigarette drooping, a fugitive look on his face, his eyes exposing a vacant soul whose only mission was the ruthless pursuit of pleasure.
Chinatown. I live in Chinatown. Every Sunday there's a wedding and loads of fireworks go off on the pavement opposite my house. Every time I think that we are under attack by terrorists. The lights in Chinatown are bright and of a number of different lurid colours. They make it look dangerous and seedy. Chinatown makes me feel sexy. There is a restaurant in Chinatown that I always go to. It is the Happy Emperor Restaurant. There is a lovely lady in the Happy Emperor Restaurant who gives me free prawn crackers and beer when I go in. I am grotesquely fat due to all of the free beer and prawn crackers. I've started going to a therapist because I'm so fat. I feel like a grease ball. My therapist is called Arnold Phillips. He makes me feel better by forcing me to eat more Chinese food. If I don't have something in my mouth, I start crying. I spend all of my money on Chinese food in Chinatown. I go to all of the restaurants on a constant quest for Chinese food. I love the smell of Chinese food. I go into the bakeries and supermarkets, stuffing food into my gob, getting poorer and fatter. I cannot afford my rent. I now live in one of the gazebos in Chinatown. I am homeless and fat. I am a drug addict. Leave me alone.
Hi, I'm Anne Hilferney, and this story is called Big Shout to Malmi Hatchman. Get near and listen up, because I haven't got much time. I've been watching you for a while, but hear me out and I think you'll understand. I'm Fenton, who used to be an architect at the Town Hall, and I'm going to tell you about Hatchman, the odd job man there all those years ago. Truth is, nobody really knew what Hatchman was all about. He was a creature of that brick warren, its covert entrances, spike gates, portals and hidden rooms behind the bookcases. A rare sighting heralded by the slow drag of his feet would excite comment. I saw that Hatchman just now sloping off to his lair, but I collared him to get me a brew. Do you think a tanner was over-egging it a bit? Nah, he's an old soldier. Let him be. Not quite Town Hall mascot, more an elemental or a familiar that those peer-end spiritualists used to talk about. Hatchman had a shonky leg. Actually, I think that's how he ended up at the Town Hall, by being a batman to some Herbert in the war. Services rendered and all that. Give the lad some tin and a token retainer now we've lamed and broken him. You could tell he was a man who'd fought to keep his sanity. He'd just about managed it. But there was something about the way he cleaved to the earth that made you think it was a desperate struggle for him not to cast adrift and float away, thoughts bobbing and whirling like thistledown, bouncing on the Albert Square cobbles, catching on the stone whiskers of Mr. Bright or Mr. Gladstone before floating free and away over Manchester forever. That's why Hatchman's slithering, shuffly feet never left the ground when he walked. He was afraid. When he reached the steps, he'd hesitate and peer around as though gauging how long he would be suspended, one foot free of its anchor, then with a perceptible girding of his loins he'd be off, skittering from step to step like a spider, as though to get the dreaded moment over with. I was intrigued by the old duffer, by his almost disassociated presence, and took to making excuses to talk to him. That is, I'd talk foolishness and he would gaze at the floor and murmur. They paid him little enough. It got him a room in a lodging house with others who were only one step away from the gutter, somewhere in Hume, I think. Fag and beer money came from his errands, some kosher, some decidedly hooky, but one flash of his campaign medals, always worn under his waistcoat, and the most hard-bitten copper would turn a gruff blind eye. I asked him once how he imagined his life would have turned out if the Great War hadn't intervened, and he smiled. Building a city. Oh, was your father a bricklayer then? Nah, what father? I mean dreaming cities up, drawing them, seeing them rise out of me and out of the earth, and then touching the skies. I checked my guffaw just in time. You wanted to be an architect? Good God. What do you think I do of an evening? I've no schooling, so I have to use my eyes and ears. Careless talk and all that. Papers left around. I listen to them in their offices and look at their drawings. I'm the sad dog in the corner that gets in their scran and dirty magazines so they take no notice of me. The city's my university. Every building I see is the conceit of man made flesh, the wrong uns, good uns, tombs for the living and palaces to go to the devil in, gables, domes, turrets, chimneys, proscenium arches and flying buttresses, gargoyles, goddesses, saints and heroes. The words were spewing out of this silent, austere man, a litany of architectural ephemera, the detritus of Manchester's aspirations, The measurements, the styles, the quirks, the failures, the triumphs. He trailed off and sagged as though sated and exhausted. I must have looked both astonished and a little vexed, as with a mixture of shiftiness, defiance and some underlying neediness, he said, "I can show you if you like." "What, you still draw?" "Nah, Curtin Mandua." I vaguely recognised the name of the Brigantine Queen, ancient founder of this city whose settlement was just down in Castlefield. Still, I had no idea what Hatchman was really on about. So I followed him. Down corridors, through doors, a spiral staircase and another corridor. Musty air, mildewed paper, grimy cases half covered in sacking. Ancient tarnished paraphernalia of state piled in a corner heap. There wasn't a living soul about, just a clammy stillness, broken only by the rasp of Hatchman's feet along the flags and the reek of his filthy roll-up. The end of the corridor loomed, apparently bricked up long ago. On the left, a wooden staircase disappeared into an almost palpable blackness. Hatchman disappeared into the alcove beneath and threw aside a heap of discarded Hessian. I saw him bend, release a bolt with difficulty, and hoist a trapdoor that was flush with the grimy flags before vanishing from sight and flicking a switch, which created enough light for me to grope my way forward and down the ladder. Hatchman waited at the bottom and motioned me towards the room with a courtly sweep of the hand that was almost poignant in its mixture of defiance, pride and fear that I would laugh or mock. Words, by one profane expletive, failed me utterly. Instead of the glory hole or cluttered den that I'd been expecting, I was in a large, fusty, vaulted room. It looked as though it may have once been a wine cellar or even the bowels of a church. I gazed transfixed upon Hatchman's utopia. Curtin Mandua spread before me, all 50 feet of it receding back into the darkness. It overwhelmed any concept of space or sense, glorious, celestial, impossibly gorgeous and utterly deranged. The model, its edifices painted in uniformly creamy or roseate colours, Hatchman favoured good local sandstone and marbles, shimmered in the uncertain light and drew you into it like a whispered promise of impossible rapture. "That's my heaven. That's where I'll go when my day comes. Do you know that the old plague pit and graveyard of St. Peter's surrounds us down here? The folk who never made it. Thousands of them all pressing their faces into the loam trying to see this, their new Manchester, the one the bastards wouldn't give them. This is for them and for all the ones who fell at Peterloo, just over there. And when my day comes, we'll all live together in Curtin Mandua. Safe. Always safe." He said this quite rationally. It was his life, I suppose. 35 years in the making. He perched on the edge of his pleasure gardens in Shudhill and told me how these Manchester souls had guided his hand, whispering to him, the breath they left behind brushing his cheek and alerting him to their presence. The delusion had consumed him like a looming fungal edifice feeding off his loneliness and the broken dreams of all those crowding in around us. It would suck him dry, that much was obvious. His eyes never left New Manchester's loveliness. There was a febrile excitement about him, and he repeatedly wiped his hand over his mouth in agitation. I never let on what I discovered, out of respect for the old man, and he knew I never would, because I too had been seduced. This underground city tormented me every day. My jealousy spurred me into sending my assistant out on a daily basis to find Mulmy and to my making spurious excuses to venture down below. I prostituted and defiled New Manchester, stealing bits piecemeal and incorporating them into my soulless edifices. Mine were built to order, for dead-eyed, speculating whores enthralled to their venality. There was no trace of Mulmy's soul, his passion and visceral genius. He saw and never said a word. I tipped him generously, both out of shame and also fear that the holder of the key would withhold it forever. So the years passed. I was promoted and grew sleek in my prosperity. Malmy, however, diminished to the point where I grew alarmed. He could barely manage the arduous climb to my chambers and would have to sit, gasping and bent forward, face over his knees. I hadn't seen him for 3 days and could barely concentrate on my work. A shuffling foot would send me spinning round in my chair, only to startle a colleague. "Sorry, Fenton, didn't mean to spook you, old boy." I kept prevaricating, telling myself all was well, but I knew there was only one thing to do, even though it felt monstrously profane. I would break into the vault. It was an interminable day as I waited twitchily for dusk, the building resonant and deserted except for some cleaners on the lower floors. It was easy to slip down to the cellars unseen. I rapped on the trapdoor out of form's sake rather than with any real expectations, and of course there was no answer. I tugged at the iron ring, realising what a racket I would make if forced to break in, but unexpectedly it opened. I'd rather not dwell on the rest. I don't know what you would have done. I couldn't find the light and switched on my torch, feeling increasingly vexed at Malmy's refusal to answer my calls, as I knew he had to be there. Kurt Mandua glowed in the murky light. I fancied I saw the treacherous old queen herself squatting there in her white gown, a bloody leer on her face. But as my eyes adjusted, I realised it was Malmy, cruciformed across New Manchester, his head thrown back across the smashed glass dome of the Brigantia Temple, where his arms were cradled in the topmost branches of the trees within. The smiling gash of his throat was horribly exposed. It had sprayed his blood over spires and turrets, leached it into the walls and flags, poured it down the sides of villas, mansions and cottages, then gouted it into the avenues and boulevards before finally decanting into the Irwell, Irk and Medlock. There were strange gusty breezes in the room, but nowhere they could have come from in this hermetic bunker. A terrible charge strung out the air. It galvanised me into throwing myself on Malmy's rigid body to tear and claw at his clothes. I found the key in his hand and prized it out. 10 minutes later, I left the building. They never found Malmy, and nobody ever thought to check the room because they had no idea it existed. I certainly didn't tell them. After a few days, people stopped talking about him, and I imagined his thistledown soul drifting in bliss over this tired old city. I never entered, never could enter the room again, but the key hung in front of my desk like a fetish for me to gaze at sometimes for hours at a time, my portal to the mystery. When I retired, it hung round my neck night and day. I am the keeper of secrets and of Malmy's soul. Here is the key. Because I'm done and you are the living breath of New Manchester. I know in my heart that it's all a delusion created from whispers of the dispossessed, but cherish it nonetheless. Cherish the dream.
House of Cards by Anyanita Green, location Deansgate, near Cromer. It is not that I am homesick for the House of Cards, Mr. Simic. I yearn for the proverbial flop of the flimsy two-tone structure, replica of the place where origin begins and comfort constructs walls. Last night we circled Deansgate with our hands tucked into the palms of each other's, though suits in the high-class restaurant stared through the window as he, his breath warm against my cheek, slowly lifted my skirt in the cold to reveal unstocking legs. One woman blushed, yet could not her eyes from us remove. I have become homesick for he and I, the way we are when we wait with our lips pressed together, whispering and dreaming up a future, naming children after beautiful English villages and seaside hamlets. I grow nauseous with missing him, with replaying Dawlish like a record on repeat, sliding my hand across his thigh as Ussie drives into the belly of whales, steering wheel on the opposite side, my feet displaced from the lack of pedals, pushing and pulling on phantom levers as he accelerates and brakes. The future keeps me awake, whispering insomnia into my mind, a lullaby in reverse. Still, I am not homesick, Charles, for that card-built house. I am homesick for the house he and I have yet to build.